It is March 12, 2010, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, geek news and your questions and comments about technology. It's time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Today we'll be doing geek news for the first half, and the second half we'll be welcoming you to call in with your questions and comments about technology. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. We haven't done this in a while, so please feel free to pick up the phone and call us anything you'd like, but not for about a half an hour. Again, the phone number, 1-800-655-5877, and I'll give out that number again when I invite your participation in about 23 minutes or so. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air, I'm with me. Oh, you know what? Did I mention that GeekSpeak is the views expressed on GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KOSP, just of us in the room. I'm Lyle Troxell, and the air with me is Miles Elam, a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
Team 8, what is it? Your shirt.
No, Tam 8.
Tam 8. Oh, great.
The Amazing
great.
Meeting 8.
You know, every time you wear that shirt, I say that. It must catch my eye somehow. I guess an 8 ball kind of gets me. Thank you very much for that, telling me that. Lindsay Lonnie, system analyst. Hi.
Good morning. I'd also like to introduce my friend here. This is Laurel Klein. She's a developer relations expert.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So you're welcome to participate in anything we talk about. I hear you're a geek, so I'll take word from Lindsay. Let's go ahead and start with Mr. Miles Elam. Your first news story, sir?
Yes. I want to start off with a joke, actually. Two scientists walk into a bar. The first one says, I'll have some H2O. The second one says, I'll have some H2O, too. Then he dies. So, moving on. I wanted to add some levity because my actual story has to do with Japan and the tragedy that's gone out there. And my heart goes out to everyone that's been affected by that and in the surrounding areas, the surrounding countries. And one thing I did want to bring up was the fact that we talk about the destruction that's occurred and the dollar value that's occurred. But compared to, for example, when earthquakes have hit Haiti or Iran or some other areas, or for that matter, Los Angeles, not many people died comparatively in Japan.
You don't want to lessen the amount of tragedy, but...
Right, and it isn't just because they're a wealthier nation, although that contributed to it because they were a wealthier nation, they were able to have better building codes.
Sure.
And so I just wanted to give a shout out to all the engineers out there, all the civil engineers, mechanical engineers, building engineers that have worked amazing hours to make systems that you don't really get any credit for.
Right.
It's just, you know, an earthquake occurs and the building doesn't fall down.
Yeah,
no one says, oh, thank those engineers for the fact that the building didn't fall down.
Civil engineering definitely gets the negative rap. You know, anytime a bad something happens, they go, what'd they do wrong? But all the amazing times that the building didn't fall, it's true.
So looking at Japan, even with the amount of destruction that was wreaked by the tsunami and of the earthquake itself and the fires, I do want to do that shout out and have people recognize that the damage was so much less because you had great engineers and building codes.
So about a half an hour after the earthquake hit, Rick, who answers our phones, got a call from home from his daughter who's in Tokyo, and she didn't lose power. She didn't lose cell phone coverage technically, but she couldn't use the cell phone towers because, of course, Tokyo is so dense that everybody gets on the cell phone. It's really hard to get a call through. But she just picked up Skype and paid, you know, called his home number. So she had internet connection the whole time.
And I think that that's also an important point, is that between 2004, you know, Indonesia, and now with tsunamis, so much more communication has come into play with cell phones and Skype. People can talk to each other immediately. It's like an early warning system.
And
also early warning systems themselves, like the DART system from NOAA, they used to only have about 6 throughout the ocean that could measure waves and predict these kinds of things and how fast they're moving. But now they have about 30 of them, and they're two-way communication instead of just receiving data. They can actually query those systems for data.
And so they can do a faster checking point.
They exactly,
can keep on checking.
And they can warn faster. They can do more accurate predictions of when waves are going to hit and stuff like that.
And we're mentioning this on GeekSpeak, of course, because this is all geeks doing this stuff.
Right. Yay, geeks.
All right, Miles, is that your first?
That's my first
I'll
news
move
story.
On to Lindsay then. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi. So let's see where to begin. Something that got me excited over the weekend, and it is kind of a local thing, but I'm hoping that it will become non-local and spread, is that there's a company called Tech Shop that opened a tool haven in San Francisco. There's already one, I think, in Menlo Park. But basically, if you like heavy machinery and tools, but you don't have a place to keep it and you can't afford it, you can pay a monthly fee and go to one of these shops and use their tools, unlimited. And they also have classes on how to use them, you know, precision, laser cutting. There was already one that's been there. They've been working since 2006, but this one in San Francisco is new. So
yeah.
I want to go check it out.
I heard about it. They were pimping out a bit on the in San Jose last year at the digital arts show that I went to. And the tech shops are great. Whenever I want to, I do a lot of that kind of stuff at work. I run a rapid prototyping lab at work. And when I want to know what kind of tech to get and how much it's being used and stuff, I call the tech shops and ask them because, of course, they've got a whole bunch of different systems, right? So computer-controlled milling machines, water jets, plasma cutters, laser cutters, vacuum forms, you know, you name the prototyping, 3D printers. It's a really cool space. And if you're in San Francisco and you are geeky, go down there and get a membership. I mean, it's basically like a you know, you pay a little bit of money and you can get to go in there. And then, of course, they have classes on all these things. I mean, mm-hmm. There's really no reason not to do
it. Geek heaven, really.
It really is. It really is. If I was closer to one. Now, there is a movement in Santa Cruz to make one, make a tech shop. Now, it wouldn't necessarily be branded with that, but there's four or five people that I know that are kind of involved and interested in doing it. That'd be great.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm in a lucky position because I get access to those things at work. And, of course, it's always work, so I'm not making my own things. But it's fun to see stuff come out of a laser cutter, for example.
Right.
Very cool. All my friends know me as the guy that's like, oh, you can cut that with a laser.
You can cut anything with a laser.
The tension was so thick, you could cut it with a laser.
Not metaphorically. I mean, really cut it.
You're on a roll, Miles.
University of California researchers and University of Washington researchers decided that it'd be kind of interesting to see if they could hack into a car's systems remotely. And I don't mean like, you know, open up the hood and plug in, because of course there's a computer in there and you can do things. No, I'm talking about use the cell phone or the Bluetooth and see if you can get control of, I don't know, the controlling driving
system. The cell communication, like the OnStar stuff.
And yeah. And of course, you know, we all know that OnStar has an ability. There's a tether point in, right? Because they can remotely unlock your car and they can tell if it's on. There's a whole bunch of things to tell location. So they did an off-the-shelf vehicle and were able to hack into it remotely without any knowledge of the system at all and control the brakes. That's enough for me. I don't know if they can control anything else, but you can stop a car quickly, remotely. That's dangerous.
Seriously.
So, I mean, talk about creepy, right? You get a good enough system on this, you can drive in the freeway, and you're like, that guy's tailgating me. All right, not anymore. Anyway.
I do take amusement at the fact you said an off-the-shelf vehicle.
I wanted to say a stock car, but you can't say stock car because stock car represents
like
a whole community that's stock car, which is really highly modified vehicles.
They're not highly modified. That's the whole point behind a stock car.
That's what I'm saying. It's been co-opted to mean a car that's off the shelf. I'm going to use that term. They do change them. Showroom floor. Okay. Off the showroom floor. Isn't a showroom floor kind of shelf-like? So I don't know what to do about this. Except
pedantic geek is pedantic.
Man, what have we been on today? It's creepy to me that a vehicle that you can buy off the showroom shelf can be remotely controlled by someone else. That's not right. Mm-mm. That's wrong.
I remember some folks doing some research. I forget which university was doing it, but they were able to find out or able to wirelessly connect up with the tire pressure sensors mm-hmm. in a car while they were in motion, like just driving by, able to get that information.
Cool.
And they were not set up for security, which means that they could be an entry point.
But was it only reading knowledge?
No, that's what I mean. They had security issues where they could predict, you know, how to get into it, and then once you got into the system, you actually had control into the system.
And you know what? This research, of course, leads very much to that question of how are we managing that security feature? I mean, talk about – there's a whole bunch of safety features.
Or rather the fact that we're not managing
right.
that security.
I mean, there's a whole bunch of safety procedures in building a car to sell to the public. You've got to meet all these different things, you know, airbag safety and all these different issues. But that's, I would think, a major safety issue. I mean, it's not hard to make an automated system that could hack into cars and stop them. I mean, that's seriously bad.
Not a major security issue until the first accident.
Oh, I see. No, I think it's a major security issue now. It's a major disaster when the first
accident. Or actually, I'm sorry, not the first accident. The last accident before the liability becomes more expensive than fixing the problem.
Well, I'd hate to see it get to that level. I would assume that, you know, General Motors, Toyota, Ford, and BMW all have this potential problem because they all have OnStar support and they all have, you know, cell phones and cell phone service and Bluetooth service connected to the vehicle. Figure out a way to manage this very well. I mean, this is
We're singling out OnStar. We shouldn't. That's the thing is
you don't have to have OnStar enabled at all. A lot of cars have the Bluetooth capability, and Bluetooth capability, you know, has a distance, and you can control the radio even, right? That's even problematic, right? Because if you take a radio and get it to full static, full volume level in an intense environment, you could cause an accident from that.
Right. You know? But there are also a lot more systems that have cell connections for their GPS devices.
Right.
That's where I think it's going to start showing up a lot more.
Right.
Well, there are countermeasures too. So, you know, you can use SMS to disable someone's phone. So let's say somebody's trying to control your car. You just disabled their phone with an SMS message. And if somebody's trying to hack into your computer system on your car, they've discovered that you can use an MP3 to hack into the computer system on a car.
Wait, how?
Was it an MP3 or was it a CD player?
It was a CD player, but they used a music file.
Oh, nice. And then it had a buffer right on the MP3.
Yes,
oh, my
exactly.
God. Oh, my God. It's awesome. Listen to the CD and all of a sudden your car is driving by itself. No! All right. So this is one of those issues about Geek Speak. We talk about, you know, research and kind of cutting edge stuff. There's no solution to this. Like, good luck.
I just thought of a really... I'm not really sure where this goes in the ethics scale with regard to driving, but to be able to, like, put one of those exploits, label it unreleased Justin Bieber, you've guaranteed that tweens and teens are suddenly going to have their brakes, like, go off.
Right.
Like, no, you can't drive.
How about a hack that's like a Justin Bieber CD, but then restricts the vehicle's speed to 50 or 40? Right. That's what happens. If you're listening to that CD, the car goes that fast.
I prefer the brake is always engaged and they can't go anywhere.
Just start smoking.
They just can't go anywhere.
No, a teenager with a brake engaged can still drive a vehicle, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I know I can. I can drive 4 or 5 miles with the e-brake on.
Darn it.
Did it last night. Okay, so let's move on. Miles, I think it's your turn. What's your next word, sir?
There was a conference known as Pwn to Own. This refers to the colloquial geek term to pwn or pwnage.
I love it when we try to pronounce these things. These are, of course, words that we recognize. I don't actually verbalize them in my head. You know,
right. It all started off as the idea of you got owned.
Right.
Was the original term, which is a curious turn of phrase anyway. And somewhere along the lines, I'm sure someone was just typing very fast in their first-person shooter, and they hit the O and hit the P instead, and it looked okay, and someone went pwned. Oh, okay.
And of course, it coined the term. And if you're curious about this kind of dialogue question, look up the term leet, and I'm sure there's a leet speak in Wikipedia will tell you all about it. But go on.
Well, Pwn to Own is a hacker challenge. That says, okay, we're going to give you these certain systems, a web browser or a certain set of software suites or, you know, whatever. And in this case, they're focusing more on the browsers. So the new Internet Explorer beta, Internet Explorer in general, Safari on Mac, Chrome, Firefox.
Okay. And this year's challenge for Pwn to Own.
This year's challenge for Pwn to Own. And if you are able to hack these systems, the first person to hack these systems
gets a free Windows Safari application?
Gets the computer that it's on. So in this case, a nice MacBook Pro, nice brand new MacBook Pro, or a Alienware computer.
Well, it's interesting because I didn't know this was your story because you're not putting them on the shared space. But when we were talking about the car thing, I was like, it'd be so great to do a challenge like that, like take a new BMW and be like, whoever can hack into this thing first, you know, wins
it. Gets the BMW.
Yeah, just to bring awareness of the security issue. It's really what this is for, right? The reason why they'd have these pwned
own systems. As a sweetener to the pot, Apple offered $15,000 to the person that could hack Safari, and Google offered $20,000.
Now, what we're talking about, are they working on the machine, or does the machine have to visit their site and then they can hack remotely? How does that actually work?
it's something that has to be legit. I mean, has to be a reasonable expectation that a user can
do.
In
the wild
so
potential.
They can go to, they can say, go to this site.
Okay.
But they can't, for example, like hook into it, say, go to the site, now click on this, now download, and now double click on this other thing and copy it over to this folder.
So a URL only
it has
export.
To be something that is a reasonable expectation that a user could have done.
Hmm.
Click on a link to go someplace is a reasonable
I guess what I'm saying is normally this happens in like a convention center place. Everybody comes together and starts working together. Or is this a remote, completely remote project?
No, this people come together to do their entry.
Are they working on the laptop itself, or are they working on their own machines? They work
or
on
they're directing the person who operates it.
Gotcha. Yeah. So whole room full of geeks. They all got their own systems. They all have their own IP address, and they're producing web pages that are hopefully going to take advantage of an extra
Or they
bug.
Put it up live. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then they say, okay, I'm ready for you to try. And they try, the user that's using the PowerBook tries to visit it. And if that other person can get, root access on the machine? Delete a file? What's the target?
They have to do something that demonstrates, they have full access.
That they have full access. Wow.
And that can be as simple as, launching an application in many cases.
Miles, I got a question for you. Safari, when you run it on a Unix-based system like Macintosh OS, it's running under the user permissions. So if the user that it's running under doesn't have admin rights, you're not going to get root access unless you have another exploit in the system.
Once you get onto a system, getting access to super user rights is much easier than getting that initial access to the system in the first
place. So as long as they have the ability to do anything they want with Safari, even if it's running in user space, that's a win.
Well, no. I mean, you still have to find some type of exploit. But as I say, I think it's a lot easier to find that exploit over an entire fully installed operating system with so many programs installed and the like to get access to.
They could potentially even look for an application that has a buffer overrun, something that is not installed on the machine.
There's stuff published about QuickTime and many other applications.
And so the OS vendors, of course, are always trying to harden the outside-facing apps, the stuff that's kind of built in.
Browsers are so complex, and they have so many capabilities, and they go to such a wide variety of sites that they are such a huge target. That's why you want to nail them down, probably more so than anything else, any other piece of software.
So has anybody won this challenge yet?
So Safari, gone. So
Apple lost $15,000 in that
gamble? Lost $15,000 and lost the laptop. Now, I do have like mixed feelings about that. They offer $15,000 or $20,000. I go, how much does a security researcher cost in their annual salary? So they just had a whole cadre of security experts.
It doesn't matter how much
money
they spent.
All working for a flat $15,000 fee.
Yeah.
I don't know that they're really losing in this case.
So what was the exploit? And I'm sure part of this whole project is that the exploit's visible to Apple.
They're not releasing the exploits until the manufacturer can patch it. And Internet Explorer 8 was also hacked, even with the Windows box that has all the most recent patches. Although, in their defense, Microsoft has done a great deal in terms of security. It required 3 separate hacks to get into that IE8 system to get past, because they're now sandboxed. In Windows 7, IE8 is sandboxed. So to get out of the sandbox, they require an extra exploit.
Does someone here want to describe what a sandbox is besides Miles?
Sandbox place to safely play with software that's not going to affect other components of software. It's the simplest explanation, I guess.
Yeah, and when you say sandbox, you're really saying that it's in a place that you can do anything you want. You're not going to burn the house down kind of space. That's the metaphor. So what you're saying is to get through in Windows 7, a fully patched Windows 7 with IE8, they had to find 3 different breaks.
They had to use 3 different exploits at the same time to get through.
That's quite a chain.
But they were still able to do it. And to be honest, there was also some chicanery going on from the vendors. For example, Safari and Google or Chrome had releases one day before Pwn.0. So patching some last-minute bugs and also changing the field so that suddenly it's like, oh, wait, I got to retest all these things and can we still get in? And so Safari still got hacked into that situation. Chrome, however, did not.
Whoa.
So
why?
Chrome has come unscathed.
Okay, I understand that it didn't successfully have a breach. Were they using Windows, Linux, or OS X?
On a Windows machine.
On a Windows machine. And still weren't able to crack Chrome, or the group didn't.
Right.
Why do you think that is the case?
Chrome has a very good security model. They were not hacked in the previous years, Pwn.0 either.
So use Chrome, I guess is what we're saying.
If you want great security, apparently, yeah.
No, I don't want great security, especially not my cars. So can I install Chrome on my BMW? Oh, wait, I don't have a BMW. Interesting. Okay, so I gotta say that just because of that, I use Chrome, I'm thinking.
And another great thing.
But as I said, like, it has to be taken with a grain of salt because they kind of changed the field. They released Chrome 10.
You mean
the day before Pono, and it was just a little too convenient.
You
there,
mean like
so.
All the hackers that are in the space probably had exploits that they'd worked on, like, I'm gonna win. And then they changed the release, like, man.
Right. And then they had to, because now you have different memory offsets, and it's like, okay, which exploits are still working? How do I
Well, thank you very much for that. We have a few more minutes until the break, so Lindsay, you got one more?
Well, speaking of Google and Chrome, this is just a quick one. They're allowing people to do blacklisting of sites. So, you know, we already know that they made some changes to their algorithm. Some people got upset, but most people rejoiced. And if you can blacklist a site, you know how you go and you search for something and then you get a site that's a farm that's giving you a bunch of stuff that it's scraped off of other sites. People tend to get annoyed with those kind of content sites. And so now they're giving people the ability to blacklist, hoping to make content more relevant in the future. And you can always unblacklist it. And when you do a search, it shows you what if one of the blacklisted sites would have showed in your result, and you can choose to still view it.
Is this like a Google app?
It's a browser plugin.
A browser plugin for Chrome.
Right.
Okay. Why not do it at the Google level?
Yeah, I don't
know. You know what I mean? It seems like move it back up to the service side. Because, of course, it's a browser plugin. What it means is that all of the content's coming through Google is being filtered by this browser plugin. And that browser plugin is then accessing some site that has the blacklist on it. And you could theoretically move that all to the search engine instead with features. But I get that. And so it's instead of a Google Labs solution, which they would have done in the past, now they're doing it as a Google plugin. What you're speaking about in general is that, and this is a very common thing, you search for a question online and you find the answer, but it's a site that says, well, to get access to this answer, you got to make an account. Mm-hmm. And really, if you search some more for the same terminology, you'll find that content's in like 15 different sites and only one of those is the source, and that one actually isn't protected at all. Mm-hmm. And that's frustrating. So I like that.
Yeah.
I might use that plugin. It's very cool. Thank you for that.
Sure.
You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air, I'm with I have Miles Elam, Lindsay Lonnie, and
Laurel Klein.
Laurel Klein.
And Laurel, you've been very quiet, but I appreciate you being here. please don't be intimidated by our expertise in this room in the sense of speaking on radio.
We have expertise?
You and I have been doing this for 10 years. Yeah.
Well, I
still mess up the theme song every single time.
And I was so stressed about the theme song being broken today because I mentioned that to you. All right. Geekspeak on KSP is supported by Cruise.io Internet, now offering flexible workspace with 10 gigabit of fiber internet in the new building. At 877 Cedar Street in downtown Santa Cruz, all the details are online at cruise.io.com or by calling Cruise.io at 459-6301. I got to say, on the first Friday of the month of March, we did an MFA show there of digital art, the program that I work for UCSC. We did some work down there, and so I was working with the Cruise.io space and was in the workspace. In fact, I got to still take a light down there, and I was pretty impressed with their workspace. You guys have been to the NextSpace, that kind of shared colo place?
No.
Miles, you've been there before. This is very much like that. It's an office environment. You pay a little bit of money and you get a monthly access to the space. It's pretty cool. And the colo location, the actual server room, is right there, which is cool. And when you actually get a box in their facility, which is, not, I think it's like, you know, moments, to just 3 or 4 days down the line continually, but soon it'll be there. If you get a box rack in there, you then have 24 access to this environment where it's an office space. So, man, if we needed that service, I'd be way on top of doing that because it was pretty cool to be down there. Anyway, it's in the old Sentinel building. KSP co-sponsors the United Nations Association of Santa Cruz County International Soup Kitchen at Loud Nelson Community Center on March 12th. Hey, that's today. From noon to 3 p.m., events include a treasure sale, silent auction, and performances by Raging Grannies and Women with Wings. Information is at 426-3101. The Geek Bit today, I just want to recommend, since we were talking about hacking systems and buffer overrides and what that means.
Buffer overruns.
Overriding a buffer? No. I want to mention Cory Doctorow's podcast. Cory Doctorow's, I think it's at craphound.com. That's craphound.com. He's got this great podcast. And one of the things Cory's done, he's a writer. He's one of the key editors of Boing Boing and a long list of things that he's done. In any case, I follow him quite well. And one of his stories that's in his new book called With a Little Help is called Epoch. It was a couple episodes ago. And it's about the turning off of the first sentient computer. So the first artificial computer, its terminal life cycle, trying to shut it down and the issues around that. Really cool, you know, futuristic thing. Miles, you love the story. You got to listen to it. And I've heard it a couple times because I listen to his podcast. But Cory Doctorow's current book, With a Little Help, is his basic idea is let's figure out how to make a successful book in the digital age. So all of his work is Creative Commons. Use anything. You do it. Use it whatever you want. Give him some credit. So you can go download his book, get his text file of his entire book. You can print it yourself and sell it. Like, that's okay with him. It's really kind of cool. And so what
as long as you get credit.
As long as you get credit. And maybe I think it's commercial. In any case, maybe it's not commercial. Maybe you can't make money on it, but you can do all this, you know, recreated work. And of course, you can use his work. And what he did with a little help is he said, well, let's figure out all the different ways that he, as the artist, could potentially make money on the book. So audiobooks, cheap paperback, expensive hardbound, you know, custom covers, you know, get famous people to write something special for one volume and sell that at a different rate. He even sold the right to pick a story. A commissioned story that would then go in the book. And someone bought that, and the one that came up was Epoch. And I'm trying to remember off the top of my head what Epoch's the person that actually suggested Epoch. If you know that information, who actually commissioned that work, please give us a call. We are taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Chartwell School in Seaside, giving students with learning variations the tools to succeed. Education about why early intervention is very important will be available at an open house 11 a.m. Saturday, March 19th. Details at chartwell.org. That's chartwell.org. And, of course, that event is next Saturday. Well, let's see if we got any calls. We don't. Let me prompt you again. We can take any call you'd like. We've got experts in Macintosh environment, Windows environment, some knowledge about Linux, I would say, right?
Fair amount, yeah.
You want to call and find out what what Git is, or Mercurial? if you already know what that is,
if you're on the edge of your seat wanting to know what Git or Mercurial are.
We can wax on about electronics, computer systems, of course, futuristic robots. You name it. If it's about technology, we have an opinion.
I've got one about futuristic robots.
A story? Okay, good. I thought you had an opinion about them.
I also have a geek bit.
Okay. Oh, you have a geek bit too?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Let's move on. 1-800-655-5877. And while we're waiting for your call at 1-800-655-5877, Lindsay, tell us about the futures of robots.
Okay. Robotex is actually the name of the place, Robotex, with an EX at the end. They're creating gun-toting robots to replace human soldiers. And so we've heard about this kind of stuff before, obviously, much more conceptual. But this one is like a little 4-foot-tall robot, and all it is a tank track with a post and a gun on the top. And so it's very simple. Supposedly it can go about 10 miles an hour and turn on a dime, and it can the accuracy is it can quote-unquote blow a 10-inch hole through a steel door with deadly accuracy from 400 meters.
Does it have a 10-gallon cranial unit?
No, it doesn't, Miles.
Just checking.
Wait, is that from Terminator?
What? No.
What is that from?
That would be an original.
Okay, really? That's really good for describing a human robot. It's nice.
But <Ba-dum-bum. laughs>
So, gun-toting robots tomorrow or the next day?
They already exist.
Oh, no.
They're already in testing. And so,
do they have Bluetooth?
Are they in Texas?
OnStar?
They have OnStar?
Are they SMS capable? Do they have CD player? I don't know. There's no telling how soon they will actually be called to duty, but there's probably already a list of people wanting to order them, but I don't know.
I bet they're going to be deployed in New Detroit. Perhaps in law enforcement.
New Detroit was RoboCop's location. Thank you for that obscure reference to RoboCop. I appreciate it.
Yes. But this doesn't welcome our New Detroit law enforcement robot overlords.
No, please tell me that there's no biological tissue in these things.
No, thankfully.
Okay.
It's all
now,
robot.
When you say...
Tastes like baby food, man.
When you say that these robots might be deployed for duty...
Yeah, I think the concept is sort of like frontline military groundwork, but, you know, or maybe protection. I don't know what it would be.
The term
used for,
duty
really.
And a robot seems inappropriate in some sense.
Yeah.
Anachronistic even.
Yes, thank you. Because it does denote honor.
I was actually thinking the other duty.
Why? You know, now I got to bring up the story about the robots that ate things to get their own energy source. Remember that?
Yep.
Yes. Mm.
So these are these robots that would go along like, ooh, organic matter, eat, 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 eat. Now I've got energy to go on. And of course the question was, how much organic matter? Can the organic matter be running from you and screaming? Will you still eat it? Oh, look, I've got a rifle now. Oh, this will be easy.
And that's when the robotic nanny reads to the robotic child, everyone poops.
Exactly.
Even robots.
Speaking of robot nannies, though, I read another story that did...
Oh, good. Someone's saving us by phone
speaking
call.
Speaking of robot nannies, where else are you going to hear, speaking of robot nannies...
We're taking your calls with questions of technology, 1-800-655-5877. Please go on. The anticipation is killing me.
Unfortunately, it's not that exciting, but they did a touch study on robot nurses and how people reacted to being touched by a robot. And they found that it relied entirely on their perception of the robot's intent. So they presented that the robot was there to clean them, and people were receptive to that. And they had the exact same touch where they presented that the robot was there to comfort them, and people didn't like that.
That's awesome.
But it's very similar to how people feel about human nurses. So right. It's not that much different.
It's really true. I like a human nurse to clean me, but not touch me for comfort. I was thinking that, of course, like when a nurse is giving me a shot, I'd much prefer him not to do that and not to touch me.
Right.
But, you know, if he's like, is your shoulder hurt? Let me touch it. Okay, I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
Okay, interesting. Thank you. We do have calls coming in. Miles, you said you had another geek bit.
It's a quick geek bit.
Sure.
There's a concept in mathematics known as an infinite series. Infinite sums, infinite series.
Mm-hmm.
And...
No.
It's something that comes up, actually, for me anyway, in the second semester of calculus. And the idea behind it is that you have some simple equation or algorithm, and the piece of it is incrementing each time. So you have something like n minus 1, where n is 1 the first time, so it's 0. And then n minus 1 the second time is 2 minus 1, which is 1. And then 3 minus 1, which is 2. And then 4 minus 1, which is 3. And you're adding them all up. And then I'm going to infinity. But there are some other ones where the curve is not quite so linear. It ends up being a bit more wavy or asymptotic. In other words, going toward an end. And you start playing around with limits there and stuff like that. And the geek bit here was a young woman explains this concept, which I'm sure really intimidated a whole bunch of listeners right now with me talking about it.
Infinite limit sets. Not just listeners. Go on.
So it explains a sum of infinite series through doodling. So she doodles, and you'll get the concept by what she's doing with that doodle.
Oh, that's cool.
And it's a YouTube video, and I'll be posting it up on Geekspeak later.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to watch that. That's awesome.
And so once you do it, you'll go like, oh, now I get that concept.
Of infinite series.
And that's the hardest part of many parts of mathematics is getting the initial concept. Because the symbols get in the way.
Right.
Once you get past the concept, it's like, oh.
You know, that's the thing with calculus. I remember calculus just being starting without conceptual stuff. And then in chatting with you about what calculus is, it's like, oh, like that makes sense. Because you talk about it in a very, non-defined way, in a broad way. And then you're like, oh, I understand what that means.
Well, I was taught from my professor, I was taught in a way that was, here's how it is used. Here's the application of that. And so you need to learn these mechanics so that you can do X,
right? I remember when Anna Dorfyanki, is that?
Dorfyanko.
A colleague.
Anna Dorfyanko.
Thank you.
Yes.
A colleague of Miles and I's she was saying, so in calculus, and I said, you know, I took calculus but didn't get all through the series.
Give the context again to why she was bringing up calculus.
She was dealing with multidimensional data structures in a relational database and saying, well, I solved this last night by folding. Is that what you're talking about?
No, I'm talking about the earlier conversation.
Well, first she made fun of us, and then she said, I use calculus all the time.
Right.
You tell the story, Mom.
Yes.
You were there. Go ahead.
We use calculus all the time, yes. And you were saying, what? I don't use calculus all the time. I'm like, sure you do. Like when cooking.
Right. She was so surprised that Miles and I didn't have calculus as our base set because she knew that we cooked. So how could you possibly cook without calculus? And we're like, I use measuring cups?
Yeah, it's like, wait, what do you need calculus for? Because she would look at the bowl and she would use calculus to figure out the volume of that bowl.
And therefore, how much flour she's added, right? So she's like, oh, I'll put some flour in. Well, that's this much volume. Like, I know that because of the shape
of
the bowl.
Yeah, it's gone up to the shape. Yeah.
So
yeah.
10% of that bowl curve.
In calculus?
Yes.
Duh.
Yes. And then so she was so surprised. She's like, well, how would you
graduate of University of Moscow.
Yeah. Okay.
And just an amazing woman.
Notice, didn't graduate from the University of anywhere in the United States. You know what? We've got people waiting for us to. So let's start taking some
calls. Do you remember the DOS banana game? That was calculus.
DOS banana game?
A little monkey that threw the banana. You had to calculate the trajectory.
Oh, yeah. Gorilla.
The
gorilla.
Gorilla
base.
Gorilla. Right.
Okay. Mardine from Ben Lomond, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hello. Thank you.
Wow, you're very faint. If you could speak louder or put the mic closer to your face or something.
All right. I brought the mic closer. Is that better?
Much better. What's your question?
Okay, good. I'm calling about our Mac desktop computer. But first I wanted to say thank you to Lyle for coming out and taking such wonderful pictures of the cast of Pippin at SLV High.
It was a lot of fun to go back to my alma mater high school and take photos for the show.
They enjoyed it very much, and we used the pictures in all our advertising and the banner, and it was really wonderful. And yeah, we were very glad to have you out there.
That's
you
awesome.
Did a great job.
You know, the one thing about taking pictures of high school students is I don't get to publish them publicly to other people. I like to take all my pictures and put them online and, like, share them with everybody. But I've got all these kids, so only I get to see them and all the parents, of course. So thank you very much for the kudos. I appreciate that. So what kind of Mac do you have? You have a desktop what?
G3.
And what's your question?
Well, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, it started just shutting itself off unexpectedly.
That's funny. That's exactly what I would do with the G3.
It is a pretty old machine, and it was we bought it used, and you know, we don't have the licensing for all the software, so it's kind of we really need a new computer, but
and a new phone.
Is this a G3 desktop or a laptop?
Desktop.
Desktop.
Okay.
Yeah, it would definitely be a laptop's always useful. I think if the question is should we try to repair this thing or try to get a new one, I would definitely recommend getting a new one. And mostly because sorry, Miles.
I concur.
Yeah, I love it when he says that. It's rare. when speaking about to me. So the reason is this: that you could probably get a much better, faster, more powerful, usable, non-turning offy computer for like $100. And so as long as you're willing to...
Sure.
The other thing you could probably do is if you talk to a friend that goes through new hardware all the time, they might, you know, go, you know, putting on this on eBay and selling for $100 just isn't worth it. I'll just give them to these people. And then you also get continual tech support. That's a really great way to do it.
Yeah, you'll totally end up with folks out there saying, I have this old G4.
Right. Oh, yeah. I mean, right now, if you have a G4... What's that?
My husband just corrected me.
Is it a G4?
Yeah, it is a G4.
Cool. You should give it away. Somebody wants that machine that has a G3. Is it a blue plastic thing?
The tower.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of a gray blue.
Does it have a little silver eye in the front that's watching all the time?
Yeah.
Yeah, I like those. Don't push that. So
it gets angry.
It's still. I mean, you are getting closer to a machine that I wouldn't necessarily toss, right? So like, I've got a G4 that I'm holding on to because I'm gonna wipe the hard drive, put a new one in, and let my kids use it because it runs OS 9. It's a lot of OS 9 educational games. But I wouldn't try to use it as my main machine. But I still think you could probably, I don't know, a G4 is getting a little closer to keeping, right?
Yeah.
It's in the line for me.
It turned itself off, and then you could, you turn it back on again, it would stay on for 20 minutes.
Well, yeah. Let me tell you what's going on.
A working G4 is worth keeping. A G4 that turns off, I'm of the opinion that the money you're spending trying to fix that is better spent
Let's spend 15 minutes trying to fix it, because it's actually something that's probably really easy. What's most likely going on, this machine is so old that there's actually probably dust all inside it, and the dust is causing the cooling system that's just an airflow cooling system to slow down enough so that something is overheating, and then it shuts off.
That's what it smells like.
Yeah, that's what's actually happening. So first shut down the machine, or just let it shut down by itself. Then unplug all the wires from it and kind of keep track of where they go, though you really can't mess up. They're going to only plug into one spot. Take it into the middle of your kitchen. No, somewhere dirty, actually. And open the panel. The panel, these things are really easy to open. There's like a little finger hole, and you just open it up. Just make sure that it's all unplugged. Keeping in mind that there is a power supply in this device that could potentially shock you, but take your vacuum cleaner and vacuum everything out. And if you want to get really classy, you could go get compressed air of some sort, even in a can, and then blow the heck out of that thing. What you're trying to do is just loosen up all the dust and get it cleared off. The other thing you could do if you want to be really, If you want to be very careful and like really special about this, you could take like a damp paper towel and wipe down all the chips. And on one of the chips is going to be a like a fan, like a little fin of aluminum fins. And this is actually probably on the CPU. It might be on a graphics processor too. That thing is the thing that's going to be coated with dust. The fan needs to work really well. And then wherever it's located, make sure that it's not like pushed up against a wall so that the fan flow can't happen. Once all that happens,
it actually has the box propped open slightly because it was having problems before we bought it with overheating.
Okay, so that's actually not. That doesn't work long term because what's happening when they design these things, they make an airflow channel in the system. When you crack the door open, that air channel breaks and then you get turbulence inside there and then you don't know where the heat's going. So the heat could stay right next to the one part that's overheating too much. So you really want to get that cleared out. Now, if that still doesn't work, the vacuum doesn't work, you could take the next step by putting more fans in it or getting another fan. Or then you're going to the step of, I'm buying stuff for this? Nah. The compressed air you'll use again around the house because it's fun to play with people. You can go, oh, look at this, and spray it in their face. But other than that, don't do that. It's dangerous. That's what my recommendation is. Try to vacuum it out. Try to air it out. Do some white paper towel with a little bit of water on it. Clean it up a little bit. Let it dry out. Close it back up and try it. If that doesn't work, find another machine.
Browse Craigslist because
you can get a G4 for $100 on Craigslist, I would say.
Or a faster machine.
Yeah.
Well, we did clean it out a little bit, and it didn't work right away, but lately it has started staying on without overheating, and we didn't change anything else.
Think of the auto shutoff feature.
We replaced the little battery,
Yeah, that's always a good thing. That's not going to be a power shutoff because, of course, that battery's not used when the machine's actually running. It's only when it's not running. Think of this thing. This is not a bug. This is a feature. This auto turn-off thing is saying, get a new computer. So every time it happens, know that that's what it means. It loves you, and it wants you to succeed in life. Thank you so much for the call.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Mardine from my hometown and where I currently live, Ben Lomond, California. In Santa Cruz, Lynn, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Quite well. What's your question? One thing real quick before I say that.
Sure.
The phone numbers for other people calling it because Lynn's the only person on the phone right now. 1-800-655-5877. Again, it's 1-800-655-5877. We'll take any questions you have. Lynn, go on.
I'm basically a PC sort of guy, but I'm working on Macs these days. And currently I have an external FireWire drive, a Lacy, which has both FireWire 400 and 800 connectors on it, but when I connect it to the Macs that I'm using, sometimes the Macs don't recognize that it's there. Normally what I do to remedy this is either switch from either the 800 cable to the 400 cable, or I just end up rebooting the entire system.
The Macintosh or the hard drive?
The Macintosh, the Mac. Is there a way that I can poke, tweak, or command the system to say, hey, go recheck and see if this drive's connected?
This is a Lacy drive.
Yes, it is.
When you do get it to work, it does work.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And you're unplugging it from the other machine completely and then plugging it into your system, right?
Yes.
Okay. Because even though FireWire drives, external drives, sometimes have two ports or more, you don't actually want to plug it into two computers. That's really the daisy chain hard drives. You only want to have one controlling entity, if you will. When you do this, do you notice the problem mostly emerging after it's been mounted to the Windows machine?
No, I do not mount this to a Windows machine.
Ever.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm only using it on these other, I only have PCs at home, but I'm using Macs at this workplace, and I'm only using this drive
on
the Macs.
Gotcha. Okay. And sometimes it just doesn't recognize it. All right. Geeks? Anybody? I'm a little void on this one. I can tell an interesting story about Lacy drives, but it doesn't help on this problem.
If it was a Windows machine.
If it was a Windows machine, what would you do?
I would just check the drivers that are installed and upgrade them.
I mean, that's one thing you can do is you can go to Lacy, see if they have a new BIOS update for your hard drive, and install that. And what this means is basically on your external hard drive enclosure, there's actually a brain in there that has a BIOS. It has software that's held in there, and it's actually in a chip, and it's burned to the chip. And nowadays, you can rewrite that data and put something else on it. And so Lacy might have, after these have been sold for a while and stuff, made an upgraded version of that. So you get a little application from them, you run it, and it will then fix, make it more reliable in some sense. The other thing to do is make sure, of course, that the Mac that you're on is fully updated as much as possible. And if another thing you could do, which wouldn't be a bad thing. Sometimes manufacturers like Lucene and stuff will actually have a driver package for their hardware, even on a Mac, and you can install that. I never do because it never seems to be a problem, but that's one another attack you could try. And I'm also going to offer for people that might know the solution to this to call in and let us know. There's only four of us in the room. There's 10,000 people listening right now, so we'd love to hear your opinion if you're a geek and you're listening. Thanks for being patient with us. The phone number to call in to ask or to offer suggestions, 1-800-655-5877. The other thing is, when you're unplugging this and plugging it back and stuff, are you power cycling the hard drive?
Actually, the hard drive is pulling the power from the FireWire cable.
Right, okay, so by default you are. Okay, then the one other thing I could suggest is, does that Lucene power hard drive have an external plug for power supply as well?
It does.
Try using that.
Okay.
Because you are drawing power from your laptop's FireWire port, and you might as well not do that, right?
Okay.
Okay, and the interesting story about the Lucene is I had problems with the Lucene drive at one point, and it just doesn't seem to work. And I finally opened it up and found out that the FireWire port connector wasn't soldered to the surface, which essentially that kind of a problem. So I soldered it and it worked fine. That was actually a fix for somebody else. Hey, thank you so much, Lynn, for the call.
Sure. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye. I hope Lynn's enjoying his Macintosh experience at the student workplace, besides the annoying non-booting hard drive problem.
The forced Macintosh experience. Yes. Just saying.
Nice. Forced Macintosh experience. Great. San Juan Batista, Mark hung up the phone, but we still love you. And from Judith from Hospital, suggests for Mardine, this is the G4 question, suggests for Mardine do a safe boot maybe once a month and maybe restart the computer. She suggests go to Disk Utilities in Macintosh and do a repair disk permissions. Oh, yeah. These are regular maintenance problem issues that we suggest on a Macintosh. Judith, thank you for suggesting them. I appreciate that. That's an example of a geek that listens to us regularly and helped with that. Again, that's Disk Utilities. Go to do a disk repair disk permissions. And then safe boot. How do you get into a safe boot on a Macintosh machine? Miles? I don't know if you can do that anymore in OS X. I think it handles those features by itself.
I used to know. Ben would know.
I know it. Ben's not here, but he will be here next week. Or maybe he won't.
Yes, those are the two possibilities.
He could be in here in spirit.
Only two?
It's a partial. Yeah, what if he's on Skype, so he's here but not really? That's another possibility.
He's always here in spirit.
Oh, that's so sweet. We have time for one more call, which is kind of coming in. We also have time for one more news story. So let's start with a news story until the phone comes in. Miles.
Sure. Curious thing about Facebook is that they do try to police the system so that people aren't making just random vanity profiles, especially ones that are negative. Like, so you don't have things like, you know, anti-Monsanto or anti, you know, this or that, anti-Microsoft, whatever. And or anti-Apple. Hey, they're probably the big empire now. Well, there's a problem because there are actually several countries where anti is kind of common. But apparently that isn't really an issue for Facebook when they're going through and doing a quick automated sweep and going, oh, look, we have all these anti gone.
Really?
So all these profiles are going away or have gone away.
Wait, so they just delete them because it's not appropriate to make a fake identity and an anti-somebody is a fake identity. So they just erased them all.
Right.
Even though the person's name might be anti.
Right. And actually someone came back and said, hey, I want this back. Can I get this back? And their policy actually is, you know, if we help, it's because we feel like it, not because we have to.
Oh, my gosh. Getting Facebook to do something outside of its online tool is impossible.
Wow. And they told him, like, you know, we have the policy against pseudonyms and you must use the name issued on his government ID. He's like, well, wait a second. This is me. I here's my identity. Here's all my stuff. And
they decided not to.
Right. Yeah. Actually, in this case, the person is a Chinese citizen and he's an activist, which is kind of funny because Facebook has been trying to take so much credit for being
supporting
in the forefront of having dissidents be able to have a voice. And this was all compounded by the fact that Mark Zuckerberg made a profile for his dog.
Mm-hmm. That's not allowed, right?
That's a pseudonym, isn't it? Because the dog isn't actually doing it. It's the person doing it on behalf of the dog. So
what about if someone can't type and someone else is typing for them? Because the dog can't type.
Yes, but that would be assistive technology for what the person's intentions are. Are you sure the dog really wants a Facebook account?
Depends. I think a dog would love to interact with everybody he possibly could. He'd be one of those people that just befriended everyone, except for people, you know, especially like sausage vendors. And
What's your status today? Roof.
Right. You got to do the translation for the dog. If the dog's laying down, you have to say, oh, it's sleepy. You know, you can't. That's assistive.
Arf.
Hey, we did get support back from Alex, who's participating from down south via our
Southern California service. Southern California correspondent.
Yes, that's right. Alex Lias, security expert. He says, never heard of Safe Boot in OS X. I think he might be joking because then he sent the link. This is how you do a Safe Boot in OS X. Be sure your Mac is shut off. Press the power button immediately after you hear the startup tone, which sounds like... Thanks, Miles. Hold the shift key down. The shift key should be held as soon as possible after the startup tone, but not before the tone. So that's one of those stress moments. Did I do it quick enough? You know, hold the shift down, and then you'll see a gray Apple icon in the progress bar indicating it looks like a spinning gear. And that does some cool features, and I'm not going to read them right now because we've got 2 minutes till the show's over, but I will later and see if I need to be doing that. Isn't it fun when you find out something so basic like that that everyone, of course, knows and should know and you don't? This was last modified March 3rd, 2011, so it's currently definitely up to date. I think we're doing the close of the show. I don't think we're going to be able to take any more calls, which saddens me immensely. Today, the geeks were Miles Elam, Lindsay Lonnie, and Laura...
Laurel Klein.
Laurel Klein. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I should have written that down earlier on the show, I think.
And she just came to visit, and we threw her on the air.
I know. You want to listen? Okay, put a mic on. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kusp.org. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. My name is Lyle Troxell, and everything we talk about on GeekSpeak is available at our website, geekspeak.org. I want to thank everybody for helping the pledge drive be so successful. Sometimes we extend the pledge drive into the second week of GeekSpeak, and when we do that, Miles and I are sweating because, of course, we don't know what we're doing. Well, we should know what we're doing, but I don't know what I'm doing. So I appreciate everyone that made sure that we didn't have to do that again this round, and I really appreciate all the people that submitted and contributed to the station and also to GeekSpeak, of course. I got 45 seconds left.
Well, I have a quick little analogy of what if doctor chats were like programming chats? Having someone say, why should I pay an expert to remove my kidney? I have a nephew who's willing to do it for free.
Coming up next is Car Talk on KSP. It's made possible by a grant from the Holly Family Fund at the Community Foundation at Santa Cruz County, and we appreciate their support. For GeekSpeak and for KSP, I'm Lyle Troxell to Laurel,
yes.
Yay, I did it. Miles and Lindsay, thanks so much for being here. And to Rick, who's back from his trip abroad, thank you, Rick, for answering phones. And to all of you called in and listened, thank you so much. We're at geekspeak.org if you have further questions. See you next week.